Welcome to the CMR Podcast, a podcast by the Center for Migration Law.
Migration is a phenomenon of all times and always a topical issue. In this podcast, we discuss migration in the broad sense. Migration law determines who can access the territory of a country, which rights migrants have, integration, as well as equal treatment, citizenship. Migration law and policy making takes place at the international, European, regional, national, and sometimes even local level. Our research aims to contribute to science-based policy making from this multi-level, holistic perspective. Researchers from the Center for Migration Law at Radboud University in Nijmegen have been investigating migration law from an interdisciplinary angle for a good 3 decades. And in this podcast, we provide behind-the-scenes insights of our research projects and the involvement of researchers in policymaking. Now, one of our current projects is the Horizon Europe-funded project Global Strategy for Skills, Migration and Development, in short, GS4S. In this project, 14 partners from 10 countries seek to better understand global skills shortages in digital care and construction sectors and foster skills development through innovative analysis. The project proposes multi-level evidence-based policies on labor migration governance and alternative ways to address these shortages in regions across the globe. In a sub-series of 6 podcasts, we will present some of the results of the project. More information on this project is in the show notes. Now, welcome. My name is Tessel Chidelange, and it's been a while, and it's really good to be back with a new episode of our podcast series. And I have for you today 2 amazing guests. Kate Hooper, a senior policy analyst at the Migration Policy Institute. Hi, Kate. And
Hi,
good to have you. And with us as well is Pablo Acosta, lead economist for social protection and global lead for migration at the World Bank Group. Pablo, it's great to have you and nice to meet you.
Thank you. Many thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, and the thing is, the great thing is, both of you have been publishing on global skills partnerships recently. And it is those global skills partnerships that we want to focus on today. Now, Kate, you're at MPI, partner organization in our GS4S project. And could you just very briefly introduce your work for the project?
Sure. So MPI Europe is leading a work package for the GS4S project. And we're focused on the role that migration can play in addressing skill shortages in the care, construction and digital sectors, alongside investing in training the local workforce and improving productivity. So we've been looking at the outcomes of mobility schemes as part of this work. But the ultimate goal of our work in this project is to set up a policy lab that will allow policymakers to think through how they can tap immigration policy alongside other policy interventions, such as skills development or automation, to address shortages. So really trying to break down some of those policy silos that we see in these conversations around shortages.
And thanks. And actually, we just had a paper on this that's actually out today. So we will have a link to that in the show notes, titled How Can Labour Migration Policies Help Tackle Europe's Looming Skills Crisis? And you did an earlier paper also, a mapping more of the different types of partnerships that are out there. Maybe very briefly, what are these mobility schemes or talent partnerships? And some call them global skills partnerships. There's all these terms, but is there a sort of one definition that captures these kind of partnerships?
Yeah, there are lots of different terms floating around, which I think adds to the confusion. But In our analysis, we define mobility schemes as referring to when someone moved from one country to another for a period of work or training. So this could be a short exchange visit, it could be an internship or an apprenticeship, it could be an open-ended period of employment. So that's sort of the basic premise. Usually they're using existing visas, so they're not creating new pathways, but instead they're providing various services to try and facilitate access. So this could be matching employers and workers. It could be providing training, those sorts of things as well. Beyond that, and I'm sure we can get into this in our conversation, there are lots of different sort of framings around, you know, global skill partnerships, talent partnerships, but those are more to do with like sort of nuances around where training is delivered, how this training is designed, and what this sort of mobility scheme is accompanied by. But that's the basic definition that we're using, and I think help clarify some of the confusion in this area.
Thanks for that clarification indeed. And I think very clear on this topic is the World Bank report, Pablo, that you co-authored, and which came out earlier this year. And here you highlight three defining features, if I'm not mistaken, of global skills partnerships. Like Kate just said, it's about training to address skill shortages actually in both countries, right? Origin, destination. Firms and governments at both ends are involved. For instance, on financing, I think that's also a very relevant topic to put forward. And of course, using existing, if I'm not mistaken, legal pathways. Could you elaborate a little bit on your report and the findings that you present in it?
Thank you very much. I want to, of course, clarify why at the World Bank we decided to enter into these conversations and this analysis. It's basically we start from the diagnosis. No, when we follow the demographic trajectory, we can notice that demographic transition is here. No, and there have been many policies that can be put in place, especially for the high income economies that are facing a rapid aging process. No, so some of them are trying to increase fertility rates, some are extending the retirement age, or increasing effort to increase, for instance, labor force participation of women. But when we start predicting, you know, what will look like the labor force in these countries, we see clearly that they're going to be needing a significant amount of workers. I mean, there is technology, of course, there, but we don't know where it's going to go. No, but in any case, we are predicting that in the next coming decade, these countries will need a significant number of workers. On the other hand, you have the mirror situation or the opposite situation in many low-income and lower middle-income economies. They're still having a relatively young population, and the challenge is how to create sufficient jobs and enough jobs that meet the expectations of this population. So basically, we are on a global potential for arbitrage in the sense if we allow international labor mobility to take place. What we ask the question is, maybe the markets can do this arbitrage on their own and we don't need any government intervention. I mean, if anything, there has been a lot of agreements taking place led by the private sector whenever legal pathways exist. But when in our review, we noticed that they exist mostly for a specific number of people, especially more on the high skill level, and not necessarily covering what we call the mid-level skill, which are the one that survey after survey, employers are indicating as having difficulties to hire workers. We're talking about construction, we're talking about truck drivers, we're talking about elderly care, no? Or we're talking about nursing. We're talking about new sectors that will demand workers, like those related to the renewable energy. So who is going to supply those workers, but where are we going to find those workers, and how we can, in a way, stimulate people and countries to specialize in that. So that's where we think that global skill economy should come. I mean, basically, it's a model, as I mentioned, that has been other models out there. I mean, many definitional names, but that at the end of the day, we are talking about similar type of approaches, which is basically how we can countries of destination and countries of origin work together in order to upgrade the labor force so that we can tackle also that skills mismatch. We think that countries of origin, especially the poorer countries, will not be able to do it alone. So that's why we talk about shared responsibility. Shared responsibility also because the countries of destination will benefit from this skilled labor force. We also think about how we can ground it into a specific sector and occupation that makes sense both for the labor market of origin and destination. So the idea here is to how we can train people that then have the option, no, to either stay home and work or migrate. In any case, they should be able to find a job. They should be able to find a job for the skill they have been trained for. And finally, how we can stimulate this flow to be as most efficient as possible. Not that that's the part of the legal pathway, which also is gonna allow more people to go through the appropriate routes, no, like the regular and the less dangerous routes when they decide to migrate, no. So that's basically the concept of why we thought there is a huge opportunity here to work with countries where there will be win-win outcomes if we let economics and not politics get in the way, and that's why we have been reviewing the existing experiences in that report. But more importantly, we are trying to bring a proposition, no, for the world to analyze and take it forward if we are convinced that this is the way to go. No?
It sounds convincing. Like, you think, why aren't we developing this kind of partnerships at a large scale? And that is actually, Kate, right? That's exactly why the European Commission asked us to investigate the talent partnerships or global skills partnerships. And the European Commission has budgets available. Yet, in practice, we see that it's not yet happening at a large scale, that European countries are engaging these kind of partnerships. And maybe a question to you both, maybe Kate, you want to start, but maybe you don't necessarily agree on what explains the fact that especially the EU member states, which is the focus of our project on this aspect, are not so eager to take these partnerships on board. Kate.
I think there are a couple of different reasons why we've seen slow progress. One is that mobility schemes are often designed to be small. They're pilots, right? So we're often talking about funding to move, say, 100 people, 150 people tops. And the motivation behind them is, I think, kind of falls into a couple of categories. So one is testing demand along different migration corridors or for different sectors. And that's where we can also learn about some of the barriers as well. So one being, for example, incompatibility of training systems or the need for additional training in order to sort of secure that job at destination. So that's one sort of aspect of it. And then I think another related area is around exploring opportunities for innovation. So there might be more efficient ways to deliver this training or design it. There might be new ways to match workers with employers. There might be ways to maximize development benefits of participants and host communities. So that could be through the contribution to training. It could also be supporting income generating activities on return. So I think mobility schemes have been a helpful way to sort of really understand conditions on the ground and to test out innovation. But I think one problem is that they're not built for longevity or for scale at present. And so we've seen sort of, I guess, rounds of pilot projects or mobility schemes that are designed with great intentions. But then there isn't really a vision to sort of scale them up. You know, they stand alone from mainstream immigration pathways or from sort of mainstream development investments. There isn't necessarily a way to take forward their lessons. And also, if they don't work very well or if they're expensive, which a lot of these are, right, because you're often setting up something from scratch, There isn't a very clear way of sort of saying, okay, well, maybe this project won't continue in its current form, but here are the lessons we've learned about how to better reconcile our training systems or how to tackle some of the barriers that make it really hard for employers to find workers in these countries or to make it easier to apply for a visa. So I think that that's one challenge, is that we're seeing a lot of activity, but it's at a small scale. And I think that making that connection of how that then sort of feeds into mainstream policy isn't really there. And I think that's why it's really encouraging to see actors like the World Bank get involved, because I think in a way, maybe we need to flip the thinking here. Maybe the answer is that it's less about designing a new mobility scheme and more thinking about how you could add mobility as a unit onto existing investment in training, in development as well, and sort of in that way, building to scale as well. So I think that's sort of a broader challenge with the mobility schemes. And then I think with the talent partnership, it then also steps into sort of a broader challenge with, I guess, competences over labour migration, which we've written about in our new policy briefs. But I think there you're also running into kind of a political issue, which is that the EU and its member states share responsibility on labour migration issues. But the EU hasn't done very well in sort of really pitching the merits of an EU approach to its member states. So we can all talk about sort of the demographic transition and the need to think, you know, long-term big picture about migration. But we all know that the migration politics in Europe at the moment are really challenging. And so one challenge is that you're sort of running up against short to medium term political realities while also trying to talk about the big picture and why it's so important to think creatively and expansively about labour migration issues. And then it's also that we've seen sort of mixed results from EU-led initiatives. And I think that, you know, from some member states, they don't really see the merits of going together with other member states and letting the EU lead on this type of initiative. They might say, well, we've got these bilateral relationships, we've got all these national policies, why would we team up with the EU and let the EU run this initiative if we think that we could potentially deliver similar or better results alone? So I think there's a collective action issue, which is stymieing some of this progress at the EU level. And then I think it also, the problem is that you have to test the concept, but also simultaneously build for scale. And I think that some of that hasn't really happened yet. But I'm curious to see if Pablo agrees or if he strongly disagrees with me on this. So I'll hand over to him.
Yeah, thank you. No, indeed, Pablo was already saying, right, that it should be more of an economic argument than a political one. Are you with Kate, Pablo, on this explanation of why it's not coming to scale, or do you see other elements as well?
No, lastly, we are on the same page. We feel that, first of all, CSP should be a means to an end, if not necessarily an end by themselves. The ideal situation is more than bilateral agreements. I think it happens sometimes, you know, with trade, no? It's how countries can end up specializing in occupation and have a multilateral, in a way, a market for people that can work globally according to their specialization. So CSP is a way to start bringing countries together, we feel that, and necessary. It has to start small. It has to start pilot because countries have a reluctance, no, to see if this approach will work. No, they want the proof of concept. And I think what we review in the report is the different experiences that countries have been doing and struggling as well in setting up some of these schemes. But we need to have a very clear goal at the end of the day. No, if we want. We, especially at the World Bank, we tend to think big, no? Happening competition. So we think that the solution, the problems are big. The demographic transition is going to be a big shock to the world. So it cannot be a solution for small boutique type of project. No, there has to be big solutions. Mm-hmm. Now, the big solution is looking at also countries that have done this specialization very successfully. So we talk about India and the IT sector, of how migration at the end of the day, it was a way to start exposing significant number of people to this sector. And eventually now India sells more IT services than bring workers to the rest of the world. Or you can see countries that have relied on migration, but specialized in a few occupations where they do this very well.
no? And we look at the Philippines, no, the experience with nursing or seafarer workers, no? I mean, you know that globally, 25% of the seafarer workers are Filipinos. So they have specialized, no? In a few occupations, they do it very well. Everybody recognizes the skills and the quality of those workers. And that's the way to go. So CFP can help countries transition into that scheme. And for us, it's key also because one of the observations we noticed is that some of these pilots or some of these tryouts were not carefully looking into what is the sector of specialization and occupation that makes sense. So it should not be necessarily looking at what the destination country means. I mean, it has to make sense also for the origin country, especially when we want to think about incentives and we want to think about the scale and sustainability. They mentioned about how to use existing institutional structures. That is very key. It may take time to work with a national training institution in an origin country because it's a huge institution, you know, and that's hard to respond. But they are in very deep need of resources that we need on trying to match the standard, global standards, increase the quality of their training. And there are also institutions that, at the end of the day, they're connected to the rest of the architecture in this country. So we can craft the CRP with an adult training provider that we pick someone and make them train, you know, 1,000 workers on a particular occupation. But then we're going to be missing the opportunity to scale up. We are going to be missing the opportunity to sustain that effort after the funding from the donor runs out. So those are the things that we are trying to come around that. So we are basically seeing as in our work in each country is how we can work with existing institutional setup, trying to strengthen systems, trying to also aim to identify the bottleneck in that particular relationship between training to labor mobility, and specifically also trying to use our platform project because we have investment projects in many countries, on training, on improving labor intermediation, they are mostly aimed to the local labor market. So we are trying to see how we can add a twist so that a few of the people that participate are targeted by these interventions can also have an opportunity to work abroad. So in a nutshell, I think this has some element. We don't think that we have all the answers on that, but I think we can learn a lot from what has been done from others. But take a talk and try to see how we can move the discussion to superior level. No,
I think it's actually very interesting. Thank you, Pablo. That you also raise the activities that the World Bank is actually taking on in countries, potential countries of origin, with regard to training and trying to expand that to have an outlook on mobility as well. I think that's very important in the current, geopolitical day and age, to keep looking for ways to cooperate internationally. So thank you very much indeed for flagging that. Kate, maybe to conclude, coming to you, what ways forward for the research or the trying to achieve the impact that you want to achieve with the GS4S project?
So we've just published our policy brief, which really drills down on what we think the EU can realistically do on labour migration in the short to medium term. I think, again, kind of picking up the tension between that long-term vision, which is that mobility is going to be a real key component of future labour markets, and the sort of political and practical block on an effective labour migration policy that we're seeing at the moment. And so one of our recommendations is on refocusing mobility schemes to really dig into some of these barriers that prevent uptake and test out different solutions. And we think this can raise a tie-in for other EU efforts around developing a visa policy, for example. So using mobility schemes to really understand, you know, why aren't employers and workers using these pathways? You know, what are some of the really nuts and bolts issues that they're running into around, say, documentation, or around the sort of expense of applying or the inability to connect with another employer. So really digging into those and thinking about sort of how that could potentially be incorporated into EU plans around you know, a visa policy around the multi-purpose legal gateway offices that they're planning to launch at the end of 2025, which, as far as we know, are basically an information hub. But so thinking practically about how some of that can feed into ongoing EU initiatives there. But we also talk a little bit about what the EU can do on its directives. So in this political moment, practically speaking, it's not really the time to address and introduce ambitious new legal migration directives. But we discuss options for sort of more horizontal reforms that could improve the functioning of these pathways and tackle issues like inadequate worker protections, which we haven't really touched on in our conversation today, but it isn't a critical issue, of course. So I think really the goal is to keep that political pragmatism in mind, but thinking sort of how the EU can identify low-hanging fruit that really demonstrate the benefits of coordinating on labour migration issues and on training as well, and thinking about how you can demonstrate that added value, whether that's through the talent partnerships or whether that's through other initiatives as well, but really making the case that governments are going to have to work together if we're going to avoid a scenario where there's a race to the bottom for talent, where we see lots of countries losing out because there isn't that coordination, there isn't that commitment to building the talent pool collectively, there isn't a sort of commitment to tackling brain drain as well, and sort of really thinking about how holistically governments can work together to, you know, address future labour market needs.
Thank you very much. I think that's a plan, maybe somewhat idealistic, but then there's the World Bank giving us the numbers and explaining that this is indeed a good way forward to address the skill shortages that we'll be facing in the decades to come. Our time is up. So I want to thank both of you very much for your contribution, for your research, your work, and for bringing it to this podcast. Looking forward to read your work and for the next conversations. Thank you very much both for joining.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.